Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Here, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Means, The Guardian's weekly look at what's what and what isn't in the ever more exciting world of Brexit. It actually did get quite exciting this week because a couple of days before EU leaders meet in Brussels for their next summit, the chief UK and EU Brexit negotiators David Davis and Michel Barnier appeared on stage together for the first time in several months to announce that agreement had been reached on a transition deal. Now, on one level, this was obviously a result. The Brexit process remains on track. Businesses were reassured that they would not be falling off a regulatory cliff edge into complete chaos in March 2019 when the UK leaves. On another level, however, the transition agreement is anything but. First, it won't even happen unless Britain and the EU conclude the formal Article 50 withdrawal agreement in the autumn. And as we've discussed numerous times on this podcast, there are plenty of obstacles on the road to that. The air was thick with the sound of cans being kicked down roads, especially the 270-odd roads that cross the Irish border. Second, the transition period is strictly time limited. It's 21 months until December 2020, and that's it, which many companies, not to mention customs officials, will tell you is not nearly long enough to get the systems in place that are going to be needed. And third, the transition period came at a very considerable cost, in the sense that an awful lot of British government and Brexiteer promises were broken and a great many red lines turned green, from money to borders, and yes, even to fish. So, let's have a closer look at all that, shall we, with our regular experts, Dan Roberts, The Guardian's Brexit policy editor, and Jennifer Rankin in Brussels. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Let's start with the fact, shall we, I suppose, that the basic fact that transition, this whole transition deal, is conditional on the final legally binding withdrawal agreement being reached in time, which basically means by the end of the year. Now, Jennifer, we've talked a lot about this, but just briefly, Michel Barnier said he was quite confident we would get there. But even if you leave the Irish question out of it, there's still quite a lot to sort out, isn't there?
Yes, that's right. I mean, even leaving out the Irish question, which still could turn into a crisis further down the track, there are still quite substantial areas for the two sides to bridge. For instance, even though three quarters of the text is coloured in green, which sounds quite positive, there are lots of tricky issues that are still left white, which is essentially red in EU terminology. Mm. And these include things like police cooperation, some Euratom issues, data protection. And these all sound very techie, but running through them like a stick of rock is our old friend, the European Court of Justice. And there's a whole chapter on judicial procedures as well. So this is going to be very complicated. This goes to the heart of some of the UK's red lines, albeit they've been turning a little bit pinker in recent weeks. So there's still a huge area there, and all sorts of technical issues as well. Just to pick one, geographical indications, which Michel Barnier mentioned yesterday. I mean, the EU has asked the UK to legislate to ensure EU protection for products such as Parmesan cheese and champagne, Parma ham, all these products we're familiar with. They want the status of these goods protected in UK law, and that seems to me a massive ask for the British Parliament to have to, according to the EU position, legislate to protect these goods. In effect, it's hardly taking back control, but yet the EU is insisting this has got to be done for the withdrawal agreement to come into force. So I think there are sort of numerous sort of traps, elephant traps there that we'll discover in the coming weeks.
That's right. So every sort of step forward we take, we're confronted with another set of concrete problems, basically.
Yes, exactly. And behind them all is the Irish border issue, which hasn't been solved, but simply delayed and could yet turn into a real crisis point when we get to October.
Exactly. I mean, Dan, that's that really is the elephant in the room, isn't it? I suppose. I mean, it was very noticeable, I thought, in the agreement that the UK had to accept that EU backstop position, you know, having kicked up such a fuss about it so recently, had to accept that default position that unless a future trade deal or sort of magical new technology can manage to avoid a hard border, then Northern Ireland will simply stay in regulatory alignment with the EU. In other words, under EU law. I mean, Theresa May herself said, you know, very recently that was something no UK government could ever accept. I mean, is there any kind of solution in sight or even dreamed of for this problem?
Well, I mean, I suppose looking on the bright side, you could say they have a few more months to try and persuade the EU that the magic wand can solve this. They've got a few more months to talk about technological solutions. And I detected, although I may be alone in this, the emergence of a plan D, if the listeners can cope with any more complexity. But the emergence of the British yesterday seemed to me to only concede the notion that there should be a backstop. And at the risk of re-entering this horrible world of the definite and indefinite article, that's different from the backstop that is already written down in the EU draft text. And I think the crucial thing is that to be fair to Theresa May, what caused her a huge fuss the other week was not just that the EU wrote down their December agreement in sort of black and white legal terms, but they did it within the framework of the single market and the customs union at a time when these are still very live debates and these are toxic words. And I think what the Brits thought they had accepted in December was regulatory alignment, full regulatory alignment as a backstop. Now, you can see why Brussels might go, well, that's the single market, isn't it? And they've kind of got a point.
Yeah.
But I think the plan D might be a backstop that says, okay, full regulatory alignment, but we call it the way we give it our name rather than your name. Now, they hope they don't get to that point still. They do hope that they can persuade the EU and, crucially, Dublin, that there is a technological solution. But it's bought everybody a bit of time. And I think that's the key thing about yesterday is everybody agreed to disagree a bit longer. And it might drive us all mad.
Yes.
But they step back from the brink for now. And I think that given that how vitally important it was to British business to have at least some progress on a transition towards a transition deal. And given that the EU and Dublin could have held us to ransom over that, on that, even more than they have already.
They could have called stop on the whole thing.
They could have just said, sorry, we're just not there yet. I think everybody has conspired to agree to continue in the mutual bullshit for a little while longer. I don't quite understand to what end, but I think that counts for progress.
It has at least postponed crisis. Yeah, okay. Well, let's talk about time for a little. You know, you said everybody's got a little bit more time. But actually, the time frame of this transition period is potentially one of the key issues, isn't it? I mean, it's clear, that both sides have at least a sort of political interest in that in the transition period being relatively short. The Britain's Conservative government first, because they're very keen to be well and truly out of the EU before the next general election, which would be due in 2022, and the EU also because it doesn't want Britain hanging around in some kind of permanent Brexit limbo. But the point about the transition agreement as agreed and announced this week was that it is non-extendable. It ends in December 2020. Back in 2016, government ministers were promising then we wouldn't even need a transition deal. The future relationship could be sorted out in parallel with the exit talks, and everything would be signed, sealed, and delivered by March 2019. Now, as a result of what we heard yesterday, it looks like the UK won't even be able to start getting down to the real nuts and bolts of the final trade deal until after we've actually left. So far from being, as the Prime Minister called it, this sort of implementation period that companies could use to get down to kind of concrete preparations for whatever the new trading relationship would be, it's now that this transition period is now going to be used to negotiate the new relationship, which is a lot of uncertainty for companies, isn't it? That means doesn't that basically mean that this regulatory cliff edge that companies were so scared of in March 2019 has simply been postponed for 20 months?
Well, first off, you've made a fundamental fallacy here, John. You've been listening to what politicians have been saying. It's clearly irrelevant to this person. What they may or may not have told us was going to happen. It
really doesn't matter. Yeah.
To what is a sort of day-to-day battle for survival by a government that doesn't know what it's doing or where it's going. So that aside, yeah. But that's the question you make. You're absolutely right. The transition period doesn't necessarily give, well, almost certainly doesn't give people enough time to solve the problem. Mm. But I'm going to borrow a phrase. I think this is one from Jennifer, so I hope she forgives me. But she's made the point that Brussels doesn't really think that British business will ever be ready for Brexit, because you can't be, because it's going to be a mess. So to some extent, you could make the transition 10 years, 20 years, but it still wouldn't kind of solve that problem, which is that there will be pain and dislocation. The thing that worries me a little bit more is that I'm not even convinced that we've got that business can go away with some certainty that a transition will happen. I mean, as we've discussed at the outset of this programme, the Ireland question will come to a head again at the June Council, at the ratification process in the autumn. There's no sign of the two sides really coming together on that, certainly not in a way that will keep the DUP on board. So if you are requiring legal certainty that you know what your market conditions are going to be in 12 months'
as
time,
a company,
which is true of all really sorts of sectors, if you're in insurance, airlines, derivatives, commercial transactions, all these sorts of things that lawyers are going to go, yes, but how do you know you have the right to operate? But any licensed regulated activity, all the financial services sector, they need to know in 12 months' time, will I be allowed legally to sell my product? Because otherwise, if I strike a contract with somebody promising I'm going to deliver something, I could come a cropper. They don't have that as of yesterday. I have several lawyers on the record yesterday making this point crystal clear. There is no legal certainty. Now, the pro-Brexit crowd, the optimists yesterday will make the point, yes, but there was always that risk, that there was always the risk that this might all fall apart last minute, or that it might not get ratified. But I think there's a big difference between the theoretical chance that the parliaments might turn around and break up the party at the last minute, and what we had yesterday, which was an agreement with great big gaping holes in it. I mean, this white space, I know they decided not to colour it red for diplomatic reasons, but at the end of the day, the white space was even more glaring. I mean, it only looked all right when they projected it on a big screen at the back of the press conference and made the type font really small, so you couldn't see how much white space there was. But every line of that white space represents a gaping hole in the promise of certainty. And that's what supposedly the this was all about, certainty. Yeah. Well, we don't have it.
Yeah. No, exactly. And Jennifer, from the EU's point of view, has the EU ever done a trade deal in 21 months?
Good question. Not that I'm aware of, and typically they do take between 5 to 7 years. I suppose if you're being an optimist, which at the moment both sides are, they say yes, there's a common interest to do this in 21 months. The UK, for obvious reasons, because it doesn't want to be stuck in transition limbo forever, and the EU for a rather similar reason, because it doesn't really want a potentially sort of truculent UK stuck in transition either. But nonetheless, every time you talk to people who were a little bit, even about a little bit further from the negotiations, they said, well, this looks like a very tall order, because it's not only about negotiating the agreement but ratifying it as well. And under the EU system, for any trade agreement, that means going through more than 35 national parliaments as well, talking about each member state's parliament, and then in several cases, regional parliaments or upper houses.
So, and we all remember Wallonia.
Yes, indeed. We all remember Wallonia, that it's a very long and drawn out process, and any single parliament could call a stop to it.
Do you think Dublin will kick up rough? Do you think they will accept this fudge?
I think they've accepted it for now, and what was agreed yesterday was basically just sort of a restatement of what was agreed in December, but I think it's going to be difficult in June, and if it's not resolved by June, it will certainly come to a potential crisis point in October, because Dublin have said all along that, along with the rest of the EU, they don't want a hard border, but nobody sees where these other alternatives are coming from. The EU has its backstop, but although they said the UK can come forward and they're ready to discuss the UK's ideas, nobody believes that these technological solutions are going to work.
But has Dublin missed its point of maximum leverage? I'm thinking, you know, if they were going to basically hold everything up until there was a watertight solution to the border problem.
I don't think so. I think it's still there. I don't detect any signs that other member states are putting pressure on Dublin, but I just got the sense that the Commission didn't really want to push this to a crisis at the moment. Maybe they wanted to give something to the UK, because if you don't have inferior transition deal in March, then the value of it starts to diminish.
Yeah.
Because, we know it's a political agreement, but just the fact of having Barnier and David Davis announcing it yesterday, it sends a message to business, even if you look at the small print and you see all the gaping holes that are there.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of small concessions, other small concessions, weren't there, made by the EU, which also I think showed that. But we'll come on to those in a second. I just wanted to talk first a little bit about some of those other UK climb downs and capitulations, of which there were a striking number in this transition deal, weren't there? Jennifer, first off, you know, British voters were promised by government ministers and indeed the Prime Minister and all sorts of Brexiteers that Britain would not be paying into the EU budget after it left, and that it would leave the jurisprudence of the European Court of Justice, which you've already mentioned. And now, as a result of what we've learned from the transition period, it seems the UK is going to be paying into the EU until something like 2064, and it's going to have to accept European court rulings throughout the transition period. The UK wasn't able to put up much of a fight on either of those, was it?
No, it really wasn't, and I think it had to. The government had to bow to the inevitable that if it did want a transition agreement, these were the things that it was going to have to accept: paying into the EU budget, its payments for 2019 and 2020, and also unwinding and repaying, paying its obligations racked up over the last 45 years or so of membership. And I think, really, there was a recognition from the government quite a few months ago that there was really no way to move on this, and it was left holding very few cards. But I think a really interesting question is how these red lines will, or whether they will be maintained in the future. I mean, does the UK want to pay into the EU research programme? That would mean future contributions to the EU budget. Or does it want some kind of access to EU crime-fighting databases? That means EU data protection rules, and that means through the back door, the ECJ. So there are these further sort of bridges to cross. when we think about the future relationship. And I think there the UK does have more room for manoeuvre, because you don't have to accept any of these things, whereas when it comes to the transition and the withdrawal, they really were under a huge amount of pressure if they wanted anything. But then it goes to a very fundamental question about how the UK wants to manage its post-Brexit future. Is there a... Where is the trade-off between taking back control and, you know, giving British researchers or business access to EU programs, institutions, markets? It's going to go to the heart of what the referendum was all about, and what the debate should have been about.
Indeed, and it's all going to have to be hammered out. Dan, you know, only very recently, Theresa May was insisting very loudly that EU nationals coming to the UK during the transition period were going to be treated differently to those who were already here. That's gone by the board as well. Britain's going to be accepting free movement as it stands until the end of the transition period now. And as we mentioned last time, the government's caved in too on fisheries. EU fishermen are going to have to continue access to EU waters. Was all this inevitable? Is all this simply an indication of where the balance of power really lies?
I'm suspicious of some of them. I think there was a negotiating tactic to throw up a bit of chaff here, to kind of give to provide some easy climb downs that could be used to demonstrate British willingness to cooperate. For example, 24 months or 21 months, I don't think really matters. Neither are long enough. But acquiescing to the Brussels timetable on that allowed David Davis to briefly look magnanimous. Magnanimous, can't pronounce the word, you know what I mean. And the same, I think, really, although politically much more toxic, the fishing thing, similarly, if you're going to remain part of the single market, the EU has already indicated that it regards access to fishing waters to be a reciprocal, the other side of the coin to the single market. You know, you let us fish in your waters, we'll let you sell our fish to our markets.
Yes.
They see those. Now, the big battle is what happens in the end state on that, because they're attempting to hold fish to ransom in perpetuity. That'll make a row over the next 2 years look relatively easy. But I do think so many of these issues were never really ones that the Brits could hold out on in a transition. It made no sense to go to the wall over citizens' rights when you've already accepted the principle that people arriving until Brexit can maintain their rights. The big question mark for me, and I genuinely don't know the answer to this, is that a clever strategy on behalf of Whitehall, or is it one that has just shredded all British credibility? Because there was an attempt to put a gloss on it yesterday again by some of the Brexiteer press, who were saying, well, these weren't ever British red lines so much as negotiating aims. And of course you go into a negotiation willing to compromise on some of your objectives. Otherwise it's not a negotiation. That you can kind of make sense, apart from the fact that we've been here about 27 times on every single one.
Yeah.
These aims or red lines or whatever you want to call them have been quickly jettisoned. And there does come a point when it starts to look a bit of a farce. I don't know whether Theresa May or David Davis have got any credibility left on this. Next time they stand up and say, we must have X, who's really going to believe them?
Yes. It does indeed pose the question, really, doesn't it, of because the Brexiteers have basically swallowed this transition deal on the promise that the end state will be as they want it. You know, you kind of have to ask, if Britain has been rolled over as comprehensively on the transition deal and Article 50 as it has been, what possible hope can there be that that UK will get what it wants out of the final settlement? But Jennifer, I just wanted to talk to one EU concession that was interesting, that kind of almost wasn't, really, in a way. The Brexit pro-Brexit people were making quite a nice song and dance yesterday about the fact that Liam Fox's International Trade Department is, after all, going to be allowed to negotiate and sign trade deals with countries outside the EU during the transition period, which was in doubt up until now. But I mean, even that looks a bit of a hollow victory, doesn't it, really, in the sense that it seems highly unlikely that any third countries are going to want to go anywhere very concrete with a free trade agreement. agreement with the UK until they know what Britain's future relationship with the EU is going to be like, which is going to, you know, they won't. So that must have been a fairly easy concession for Brussels to make, no?
Yes, indeed. I agree with the whole premise of your question that it's a concession that's really not much in the making. It feels like very thin gruel, doesn't it? That the UK now can negotiate, sign, and ratify international agreements, but provided they don't come into force during the transition period. Well, what does that mean? That means that yes, it can embark on negotiations, but at the same time, as you say, other countries will want to know what kind of deal the UK will have with the EU. That will affect their negotiations. And then, of course, there will be so many negotiations to do. The British Civil Service will be sort of working flat out to negotiate all sorts of trade deals, and not only trade deals, but other international agreements. And I noticed yesterday, Michel Barnier, he again referred to the 750 international agreements that the UK will have to renegotiate after Brexit. And so it's not the first time he's mentioned it. And there's always you get the sense, a little bit of glee about that. That sort of good luck with
good
that
luck
task.
With that.
It doesn't feel like a concession that anyone in Brussels is losing any sleep over.
Monumental.
What's the French for Schadenfreude, John?
Very good question. Let us, because we're wrap up really by looking forwards a little bit. We touched on it already a little bit. I'm just interested in your views, assuming that, you know, there's a lot of assumptions to make here, but assuming that a solution is somehow found for the Irish border and that all those other white areas and holes in the certainty that Dan and Jennifer referred to, get turned to green, and the withdrawal agreement does get signed off and ratified, then are there any clues in this transition deal about the future relationship? Dan, is that, you know, I said a couple of minutes ago that the Tory Brexiteers are saying they're basically happy to put up with all this kind of string of capitulations as long as the final deal is the right one. But I mean, surely it's the case that the Britain has basically been pretty comprehensively steamrolled over the last sort of year and a bit. What is there to say that process will not continue in the negotiation of the end state?
Well, I think their game is to get us past the point of no return and then have a new prime minister and then do this all over again, but with feeling. I mean, I think that this is all about...
What a depressing prospect.
This is... as far as Theresa May is concerned, this is about damage limitation. This is about sort of keeping the party together long enough to get them to the promised land. Now, I think in her vision of Brexit, that promised land is pretty sparse and barren, because I think it looks like a very soft Brexit, and the clues are there in many respects. The concessions we've been talking about are all pointing to a long-term future that looks quite Norwegian. But the Brexiteers are willing to bite their tongues and bide their time on that, because they still feel that everything is still to play for in the long run. And if you put the transition deal aside, which in the history of the great Albion that they want to resurrect, these 2 years will be a mere blip in the eons of prosperity ahead. They don't really care about the 2 years, as long as they still get to have the big fight, which is, you know, close alignment or not, which is now one that happens after exit. I think the terrible thing...
But surely, I mean, the UK's position is going to be even weaker after we've left, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's assuming that negotiation is on the cut. I mean, I agree. I don't think in terms of asking for things, we'll be even more supplicant by that point. But I think you have to put yourselves in the head of those who really do think that the walking away is still a real option.
Yeah.
And I think walking away in a funny kind of way is more of an option after you've gotten a withdrawal agreement, because then the plane is not it's not a black and white overnight thing. Then it's the planes don't stop flying, it doesn't all grind to a halt. It's more of a sort of long-term strategy of sort of turning our back on Europe that I think that they want to pursue.
Jennifer, how does the EU see things playing out, do you think?
I I don't think there's a lot of emotion in how the EU sees it, in the sense that they're saying, well, look at the Brits, they're so weak, and now we're going to get one over them on the future relationship. I think really people are looking at it with a very cold-eyed logic of the EU's own interests, and that is that after Brexit there'll be a block of 450 million people, and they'll want to protect the EU's legal order, has been said many times, to protect the single market. And while, of course, different countries have different interpretations of how you might see the common interest and their own special national industries, nonetheless, for all of them, there is a common theme keeping them together, that it has to be better to be inside the club than to be outside. So why would the UK get anything that that wouldn't be available to EU members? And constantly, the EU is one long, very sort of complicated process of finding agreement within its member states, whether that's on very technical regulations or on a common foreign policy. So I think the fact of trying to sort of keep the EU together will become
the sort of the overriding objective.
Yeah, will become the most important, will remain the most important factor.
OK, well, that's it for this week. Thanks to Dan, Jennifer, for joining me once again. Next time, we're going to be looking at citizens' rights, both the rights of EU citizens in Britain and British nationals on the continent. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, please do email us at brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. Please subscribe, review on all your favourite podcatchers, join the discussion on Twitter. You just need to search for Guardian Podcasts. Till next week then, I'm John Henley. The producer was Rowan Slaney. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.